been in touch with you for last almost 2 decades, but talking to you first time, and that too on Skype. Very happy to be in touch with you finally. I know that you're a quantum physicist and also deeply interested in the Vedanta and Indian heritage in general. You have published a lot of books and a lot of articles. So please accept my welcome and my thank you for your time. So please tell me and my all our viewers how these two seemingly very different domains of quantum physics and Vedanta, how they are connected, how they can be compared, and if so, how, and so on. So please, sir, all for you, all to you. Over to you.
Well, to begin with, I'd like to say in general terms that Indian philosophy, and I'm going to talk in terms of philosophy more than anything else, mm-hmm. has at its core certain profound insights into the ultimate nature of the world and the human experience. The basic thesis of Indian philosophy do not simply substand speculative systems any more than, let's say, Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism are telling us something about only mathematics. So the proponents of Indian philosophy were telling us something that is not only meaningful, but revelatory of the ultimate nature of consciousness and the cosmos. They were not building a system of thought so much as unveiling a not so apparent dimension of reality. So their assertions were not just doodles on the mental plane, you know, like philosophy often is, but they arose from experiential certitudes. Mm-hmm. And that resulted from what I would call the sustained tinkering with the subtlest centers of the inscrutable self. Mm-hmm. So their words and wisdom are to be taken not as imaginative poetry, but as findings and discoveries about the physical universe. Mm-hmm. Exactly as 20th century science, after persistent probings into the heart of matter and energy, after countless hours of search and reflection, has erected its own views on fundamental reality. So if this is so, in other words, if spiritual probings via yogic exercises do lead us to insights about the ultimate nature of physical reality, while scientific peelings of the layers of matter via experimental ingenuities and mathematical formalisms lead also to the deep down details of that same reality, then one would expect the two lines of quest to merge, somewhat like travelers by jet planes and by ocean liners, starting from the same point, could ultimately meet at the same dimensions. Mm-hmm. This, in a way, is precisely or seems to be happening in our own times. It turns out that the philosophical quagmire into which quantum physics has been sliding ever since its inception, I would say, turns topsy-turvy our common sense pictures of a solid, substantial world of cause and law, of rigid particles and conserved quantities, of smooth flowing time and three-dimensional space. So as we delve deeper into the remote recesses of atoms and nuclei, funny things begin to happen. Mathematical clouds of probability take over. Electrons seem to be knowing, and information seems to get transmitted instantaneously. Everything seems to be interconnected. And a good many more strange things are taking place in the microcosm. So in the depths of black holes and in the singularities of quarks, space and time and physical laws themselves get warped and dissolved. Now we begin to wonder if those rishis of India had not, after all, stumbled upon some profound truths about the perceived world, which, because of that very nature, could not be adequately expressed. They were perhaps quite right in insisting that in the dark, in the stark, denuded aspect, stripped of mute matter and measuring mind, there is a level of reality that only pure consciousness can experience, and pure consciousness can only experience, not convey. So could it be that now at long last, after countless tortuous turns of reason and experimentation of mathematics and microscopes, science is slowly beginning to get a glimmer of what the sages were talking about? We don't know. Now, quite a few modern investigators are persuaded by this possibility. That is why in our own times, many eminent physicists and philosophers of the quantum world, commentators and speculative thinkers alike, are drawn more and more towards this ancient wisdom. It would seem that there is much to be gained if the yogic quest, on the one hand, stripped of its mumble jumble, and no-nonsense empirical science, on the other hand, stripped of its rationalistic straitjacket and model-building prejudices about what can and what cannot be, combine forces in unscrewing what I call the deeper mysteries of the world of experience. So those will be my preliminary comments on this topic, and then we can go to specific questions.
Mm-hmm. So I remember reading a book called Tao of Physics 25 years ago or more. Does that book still hold the same value? Apparently it sold millions.
Yeah. Millions of copies. Yes. Now there are two points here where I did read and review their book, and I appreciated the efforts of the author.
The Geoff Capra?
Yeah, Capra. The thing I hesitate, however, as a professional physicist, is not to identify what may be called ontological assertions about the universe with insights which are very, very not only deep but parallel in the visions of Indic thinkers and quantum physicists. In other words, what is interesting is that when we go into the deeper implications of what physical science, experimental science based on instruments and theories and mathematics and so on, what they reveal is not what the ancients revealed, but the implications of what they reveal in terms of our deeper perspectives on life and experience and the experience of the physical world at its deepest level, there are uncanny parallels, you see. And that's what makes it very interesting. There are books to the effect that, you know, the quark theories in the Purusha Sutta, it's a matter of interpreting. I don't subscribe to, I respect those kinds of things. Those are not what I think are persuasive or even meaningful. We have to distinguish between deeper insights about the nature of reality and consciousness on the one hand, and details and practical interpretations of perceived reality based on logical reason and experimentation. So it is extremely important, it seems to me, especially at a time when we are not just rediscovering but reaffirming the great truths of our tradition and philosophy. It is important that we do not confound the two, conflate deeper insights and recognitions with the more concrete aspects or discoveries of what I would call, I don't want to use the word materialist, but more physical sciences. See? Mm. So that's the thing. And many scientists, including the founders of quantum mechanics, have recognized the greatest contribution of Vedanta, for instance, and the Indic thinkers, as nowhere else in the ancient world, among thinkers or religious leaders, nowhere else has one insisted on the relevance and centrality of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Physics has been enormously successful in the past 3 centuries and more. But what physics did not, and for understandable reasons, explore was what human consciousness is all about. This is, of course, a matter of great interest to current scientists, and there are many scientists who are working on consciousness from the perspective of physics, mm-hmm. and neuroscience and so on, which is fine. But the fact that there were thinkers who reflected on this matter as something extremely crucial as living beings, from not simply in speculative terms, but in experiential terms, as did the great sage thinkers of India. I think that is where the true greatness of our tradition lies.
Mm-hmm. So that, I guess, leads to the question that you said that only Indic thinkers developed the idea of consciousness. Would you, what's your view on this whole question of science and religion in India and elsewhere? Does Indian situation seems like a bit unique when it comes to the idea of science and religion? Are they two extremes, or are they two parallelly working together in India or in each other?
Well, that's a very, very difficult question, because historically, mm-hmm. the conflict between science and religion mm-hmm. in the West arose for 2 important reasons.
Mm-hmm.
One is that modern science, I emphasize the word modern, began in Europe
mm-hmm.
at a time when the prominent paradigm was a Christian worldview, the religious Christian worldview. And there is no question but that the findings and insights of modern science blatantly, embarrassingly contradict some of the assertions in the scriptures of Christianity. This inevitably led to conflicts, open conflicts. At the same time, the religious thinkers, the theologians of Christianity, were keeping abreast of what is happening in the scientific world. So there were open discussions between science and debates between scientists and science informed religious leaders.
Mm-hmm.
In India, for various historical reasons, the religious leaders had and still have perhaps very little knowledge of technical science.
Mm-hmm.
And the technical scientists, on the other hand, they kept away from what may be called theological or metaphysical thoughts. They, and this is one of the greatness of Hinduism to me, as a Hindu I'm saying this, I can go to a temple, Hindu temple, mm-hmm. or a Jain temple, or any of our temples, and pay homage to the icons of my tradition,
mm-hmm.
and immerse myself in that spiritual atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
without in any way being bothered about whether they are in consonance with or they contradict the findings of science.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very difficult for people of other religious traditions to do that.
Mm.
So in India, what has happened, scientists, most of the scientists I know, and I dare say many, many scientists, keep the two apart.
Mm.
They do not engage in public debates or in articles as conflicts between these two. Mm. And interestingly enough, the Upanishad, the seers, mm. centuries ago recognized this when they said that there are two domains of thought, mm. what they called the apara, which is the kind of knowledge that we and I are dealing with in everyday experience and which science is also exploring in greater depth, which is based completely on our sensory perceptions, you see. And the para-knowledge or transcendental knowledge, which from a neuroscientific point of view may be looked at differently. It's another kind of recognition. Mm-hmm. But the Hindu thinkers, I think, were the first to realize and articulate this essential difference, which was to come to the fore centuries later.
Mm-hmm.
The conflict between what we call science and religion was very simply put as the para-knowledge. By the way, there were Islamic thinkers in the Middle Ages, like Al-Ghazali. Al-Ghazali said that these are two separate. You cannot use your logic and reason to examine the Holy Quran. It's a very interesting. He said that several centuries after the Upanishad, people said. And in our own times, you must have heard of Stephen Gould, who talks about noma, the non-overlapping magisteria, saying that science and religion belong to two different domains. So that is a very interesting insight, because the human mind and the human experience is way too complicated to think that it is either pure logic and experimentation,
mm-hmm.
or that it is purely spiritual and transcendental. You see, we have to recognize the reality of both as human beings and understand, more importantly, when each one becomes relevant and pertinent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That reminds me of another debate goes on between people like Richard Dawkins, who say there is no consciousness, and then other camp that says consciousness is the final reality. You want to say something on that debate?
Richard Dawkins, Hutchins, and many others of what they call the new atheists.
Right.
I don't think even Dawkins says there is no consciousness. What he is arguing for, like the new atheists do, that consciousness is an outgrowth of or an emergent property of the extraordinarily complex human brain,
right,
which is which is almost a truism, it seems to me, and what the challenge for science, hardcore non-materialist science, is to find out the link, you know, what the philosopher Chalmers called the hard problem, the transition from physical inputs, whether it's electromagnetic waves or sounds, those are physical inputs. They come into the brain and they are transformed into meaning and awareness. And this we have not, as far as I know, we have not been able to explain. I will not decry science on that basis. I'll simply say it is one of the mysteries. It's a challenge. Now, the difference comes, it seems to me, between those who think that it can be explained through brain chemistry. That's one school of thought, which is in consonance with the scientific spirit or the scientific paradigm, that everything can be explained in terms of matter and energy in space and time. So this is the very foundation on which science is working. But there is the other school, and that is that now there are things that transcend physics and chemistry. So these are, I would say, two different schools of thought. Now, my personal view on this is that no matter what science says, no matter what religions say, as a thinking human being, we are confronted with what I call some great mysteries, with a capital G and capital M. There are small mysteries and great mysteries.
Yeah.
Science is an expert at resolving the small mysteries. And it has done so far better than any other effort all through humanity's history, modern science has done. But the grand mysteries, which include things like, why are we here in this very small bracket of time in cosmic history? What is going to happen to us after we die? See, how did even the very first spark of what we call the Big Bang occur? There are grand mysteries which have not been, and in my view, cannot be explained. Those who try to give answers to grand mysteries are the great religious leaders. Every religion consists of answers to grand mysteries, whereas every science is an answer to any of the small mysteries. So I often feel I'm grateful for the small mysteries that have been explained by science. And I'm grateful for the manifestations of some of the grand mysteries, such as everything like love and joy and laughter and community. All these things are manifestations of the grand mystery. And I am happy to be part of it. But I'm equally happy to say, I do not know. It's not within the reach of my brain to grasp them.
Right. Yeah, you said that, especially in modern times, Indian scientists do not delve into the topics of spirituality and vice versa. How would you comment on the phenomenon of the mathematician Ramanujan, who said that his mathematical discoveries are blessings from Saraswati?
Yeah, exactly. That, to me, that's a grand mystery. Now, for instance, Ramanujan never talked of the about the conflict between science and religion. Rather, he very correctly, in my view, it's exactly the grand mystery.
Mm-hmm.
How Ramanujan got his magnificent theorems, which, as we well know, not all of which could be proved in his lifetime, and today there are mathematicians working on them. How did Tyagaraja compose those magnificent kirtanas? You see, how did Valmiki or Vyasa manage to write such wonderful epics, you know, with such perfect meters and sound? These are not things which, these are part of what I would call the grand mystery, you see. So Ramanujan rightly said, you know, you can take it as a metaphor or literally, that the village goddess revealed to him the secrets. Absolutely, there is no other way we can say whether you and I believe in that particular goddess is not the question, but that it came from some unknown source.
Right. Do you think this kind of phenomenon we can find in the modern scientists in the Western world also? Do they also ever attribute such discoveries to spirituality? Or?
Well, they may not use the word spirituality, but for instance, Kekulé, who discovered what we call the ring structure of benzene, he said that he got he had a dream. You might have known so about a serpent, holding on to its own tail and so on. So there are people who have conceded, accepted that greater or what we call insights, what one calls a Eureka experience. Right. These are absolutely unknown sources. Right. You see.
We talked about Vedanta, and you are an expert on Vedanta and quantum physics. Have you also thought of Buddhism and quantum physics? How do they compare? Which does not accept?
Well, as you know, Buddhism. The Dalai Lama has written extensively on this, including the World in an Atom is one of his famous books. I'm sorry, we are disturbed here by Yes, Buddhist thinkers, let me add right away,
sure.
Since in this context, see, every great religious tradition, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, they, in recent years, meaning in the past 100 years, they have all tried to build bridges between or establish parallels between their traditions and so on.
Right.
So the Chinese, for instance, philosophies, yin and yang is sometimes spoken in terms of the complementarity principle and so on. So yes, that is the case. But I think in the context of quantum physics, to me, the most important thing is the idea of consciousness, because quantum physics, above all, has brought us to the realization that understanding or interpreting fundamental phenomena in the quantum world cannot be done without the, one says, observer and observed, but actually, the observer is what I would call a materialistic, not in a bad way, substitute for consciousness. See? And so it is the consciousness does play a role. For example, all through science, we have the principle of causality, cause and effect. There's nothing without cause and effect. But the Hindu thinkers were very insightful, in my view, in introducing a third aspect. There is not only cause and effect, karana and kriya.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a third factor they introduce, and that is the karta.
Mm-hmm.
That means there is an agent involved in cause and effect. In simple, as a simple example, see, if you throw a ball, as we know, it has a parabolic orbit and we know where it will reach and so on. Physics does it wonderfully. But what we call the initial conditions, who threw the ball at that particular angle, inclination, or with that speed, that is not taken into account in the mathematical physical explanation. So the karta plays a role.
Oh.
So I think this is a very deep insight in talking about causality. Likewise, in quantum mechanics, the what happens to a particular electron or whatever depends on the observer, on the experiment, as you well know. Now, that is a case where the karta aspect plays a role.
Right. See?
To me, these are very deep insights. It's more important to reflect on these than to say, oh, we knew the blueprint for the airplane and all that. You see, this is totally different. The, or take the simple case of... you know what, without using technical terms, what happens to a particular electron or photon depends on the particular observation that we make, you know, the collapse of the wave function. So what we do will have an effect on the future. Right. Again, parallel, not identical.
Yes.
That's what the law of karma says.
Right.
As far as human beings are concerned, what we do today will have an impact later on. Now, you see the very interesting parallel between that idea and the quantum mechanical idea of, you know, doing an experiment and making the wave function collapse. So I am more amazed and struck by these deeper parallels in the insights than in the details of what they say.
Okay, wonderful. I think we like to close now. Any concluding thoughts you want to share on this?
My only concluding thought is that we, India, with her great spiritual traditions, has also embarked in the modern world with different kinds of frameworks. Mm-hmm. And there are two things in the modern world we have to recognize. One is the so-called scientific interpretation of things, which thanks to our history, we have had a long history of that, but now many Indian scientists are contributing significantly to the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also another aspect of science which came about in the West through the so-called Enlightenment, and which has independently also has become part of the Indic tradition, and that is respect for all, tolerance for all. These are ingrained things in our worldview, our religious worldview. And I like to think that we will continue to uphold those deeper values along with the worldviews.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Professor Varadarajan, and hopefully we'll talk more on some other day. This is a great start to this very complex and fascinating topic. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a